Now, if you're going to, you know, if any of us in this room is going to write a resurrection story, we would absolutely have to have Jesus appearing before Caiaphas and Annas or Pilate, and, you know, and, oh, man, what a moment that'll be, you know? You know, he's Pilate, oh, you know, oh, that'd be a blast. So you couldn't miss it, and you couldn't resist it, and yet there's none of that in the Gospels, not even a hint, none of that. In fact, the whole resurrection thing is so low-key, and so just kind of like, boom, 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 this kind of matter-of-factness, it's just, as Metaxas says, there's something really compelling about this, about just the way it's laid out. And that's to its strength. Also, the strength of this, and this gets some of the stuff we dealt with in Stein, is the fact that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all tell the resurrection story in very different ways. So different, in fact, that to actually reconstruct what happened on Easter morning takes a little work, to be honest. Okay? So, and you guys maybe experience this. If you have done any work in this, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you get ready. You know, because it takes a little work. You know, what happened? Where's Mary? What about the women? It says just Mary was there. And it says the women here. And then you have one angel. You got two angels. Or you got a young man. And you got the angels. And you got some of them speak, some of them don't. You got John and Peter coming and running and looking in. Then you got the whole Emmaus bunch. How do you get the timeline? Getting this all to work out. You know, boy, one thing is pretty clear is the garden tomb was a pretty busy place that morning. You know, a lot of traffic in and out. And so, you know, it's in that you say, you know, if you're trying to contrive a story, you get your story straight. And what you would get if there was a contrived story is real consistency right on the line, bang, bang, bang. But you don't get that. Instead, you get just kind of, here's this account, here's this account, here's this account. How do they fit? Well, they, you know, they do, but we're not worried about that. We're just trying to tell a story. And that lends to the credibility again. Okay? All right. Anything else on cross and resurrection, any of the Easter stuff? There's tons more we can go into any of this stuff. But anything else here that you want to point out, ask about, something Metaxas said or didn't say, or anything else here on this whole, the whole Good Friday through Easter morning stuff?
I'm just curious. I've heard this response before, too. Your point that you just made about if you're trying to fabricate a story, you get all the details straight,
right,
and everybody tells it the same way.
Yeah.
I've often heard the claim said, well, they weren't all working together on this. They just kind of all came up with their own story, believing the things they wanted to believe. So I guess from that point, that's a fairly easy rebuttal.
Oh, sure.
If you don't believe it in the first place.
This is going to be the case all the way down. I mean, if you don't want to believe this, you're going to be able to rebut almost every one of these arguments one way or the other. I mean, it's just the way it goes. And so are there alternate explanations? Sure. Take one of the, take your pick, you know, and just hang on to it and believe it and make it go. But it's one of those kinds of things where you just say, let's look at the evidence and see what's going on. And if you look at the evidence from a neutral standpoint of where you're going to grant the possibility of resurrection, the resurrection accounts for these things much more effectively than any other explanations do. But if you don't believe it, you're going to be able to discount every piece of evidence right on the line. Agreed. All right. Yep.
I think like just another important thing to remember too when you're talking to someone is they have to have faith in their explanations just as much as you do. You know,
absolutely.
It's not like one's illogical and one's illogical. It both gets down to having faith.
They want to spin it this way. They want to spin it as this is the logical, empirically verifiable position, and yours is not. But it really does come down to exactly right. And this gets to a much wider issue, which I always have a very difficult time trying to communicate to students or to anybody, just because we don't see it. But the fact is, even the choice to live in a scientific, empirically based world is a choice. It's a faith commitment. To decide the world works this way is a decision. And actually, we don't get this because we are so accustomed to science. We see science around us. We see the results of it, technology. And we've become accustomed to thinking that's how things really are. But we have to realize this is a choice about defining things. To be able to say that what a flower is just the constituent parts we can decide. Or is there something more to this metaphysically? And before the advent of the Enlightenment, and really not until probably mid-18th century, before that, I mean, Francis Bacon is really kind of the father of all this, before that, no one ever assumed that was all there was. In fact, if you said that's all there was the empirical stuff, you'd be laughed as an idiot, because there's obviously more reality to it. And so we have to realize that in our radically scientific, technologically, empirically based world, this is a faith choice that is refusing to look at other things which can be legitimately looked at as real-life explanations for things. So that's well said. All right? Good. Anything else here? Yeah. Jim.
Yeah, in China, in East Asia, even East Asia, many people believe the theory of reborn and the people die.
Oh.
So sometimes people witnessed something ghost.
Okay.
Their parents or their grandfather and grandmother.
Mm.
But in the Bible, when we look at the Jesus resurrection, it's similar to kind of ghost in penetrate the world,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. But how can we discern kind of the Jesus resurrection between, you know?
There's a difference between resurrection and revivification. To revive means you just kind of the body's back. Resurrection means a resurrected, glorified body. And the very fact that Jesus eats fish is one of the big things, okay? He eats. He is doing things bodily. And he doesn't do it just once. You know, you got the time when he's with the disciples at Galilee as well, when he's cooking breakfast for them. And so you got this very tangible, it's a physical body. And you got the fact that he tells Thomas, touch me. So he's got a real physical body. And you also, you know, Jesus says, do it. And it's not like Thomas says, well, I won't. No, do it. And so Lenski argues, Thomas will be obedient. He touched him. But anyway, he's tangible. He's real. It's a real body. All right. Yeah, Joel.
Isn't some of the difference there, too, the fact that a revived body, the revivification, is going to die again?
That's right. Lazarus is an example of that. Yeah. Lazarus is revivified. He's not really resurrected. And so when we talk about, you know, Lazarus coming back from the dead, that's the right way to talk about it. Don't talk about Lazarus' resurrection. He's not really been resurrected yet. He's waiting just like the rest of us. Right. Okay?
It was at this chapter that I thought Q actually started to catch on, and had some more responsive answers to things. So
he's coming
seems to
tie
good
in for Q.
Here.
Sarah feels better about that.
He definitely
exists. Oh, he does. He's a real fictional guy.
All right. Now, some other things then. Let's talk about some other things in Holy Week and cover a few more details here that are of significance, just, you know, that we could get into. A lot of this stuff you're going to encounter when you start doing Bible studies and you start preaching on these things. You're going to dig into this stuff more. You're going to start digging into commentaries and learning these things. But there are just a couple things I want to call to your attention just kind of quickly and maybe set some trajectories for you as you think about some of these things. All right? One of the first things, before we leave this whole crucifixion and resurrection kind of nexus, we need to realize that these should really form a single event. And this is important for the life of the church. When you're serving in your congregations in the future, I really think this is critical that you begin to think about Holy Week as kind of an event, not as a series of separate little things. Like, okay, we got Palm Sunday, we got Monday, Thursday, we got Good Friday, and we got Easter. Really, they're one event. And Burschen will really emphasize this for you. The fact that in the early church was essentially from about Thursday until Sunday, you just had kind of one continuous service. You would kind of come and go and eat and do other things when you needed to, but the service didn't end. And this is still reflected in our liturgy, because when Good Friday is done right, there's no benediction. There's no benediction. Right, and it's not just, and there's no postlude. And it's not just because, well, it's too sober for the benediction. No, it's because we're not done yet. Exactly, we're not done yet. So we've got Jesus in the tomb, and this is very sober and very somber, but hey, we're not done yet. And so come back soon. In fact, come back for the Easter Vigil tomorrow at midnight, and we'll have the Easter Vigil, and then come back again on Easter, and we'll have the celebration, because you see, we're not done yet. It's all one event. Which is why I'm still a huge advocate of handing out tickets on Friday, and you can't come to church on Easter without your ticket. You know, that'd be a real bummer for all the Christers, though. What are they going to do? They can only come once a year then. So that'd really be throwing a monkey wrench in things. But I mean, how can you celebrate Easter if you haven't been through Good Friday? It's nonsensical.
You just give them front seats or back seats.
Well, it's just nonsensical. So the point is, what we need to do is, you guys need to get this in your minds and talk to people about this. We need to pump up Good Friday so people realize, you know, this is not, I mean, it's kind of optional things. This is it. And by the way, also, when you start to think about this stuff, these things just kind of grow into huge significance. So, one more thing before we leave the cross. And this is the whole question, and we're going to talk about this again later with Pieper and some other things. But what's actually going on the cross? And Stein talks, Metaxas talks to us about this a little bit, where you've got the cry of dereliction, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, right? So what's the point? And Metaxas points out, he's quoting Psalm 22, Correct. Correct. And Psalm 22 actually becomes a psalm of confidence in God and of God's deliverance, which fits really nicely. But yet Christ is still calling out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And as Stein pointed out, he's no longer saying, my Father, but my God. One of the rare times when Jesus calls God the Father, God. So we have this cry of dereliction. And what are we supposed to do with that? What's going on here with this? Well, the best explanation, I believe, is to go to the understanding of what's actually happening on the cross. And what you have going on the cross here is the actual judgment of God the Father on His Son, who has become, 2 Corinthians 5:21, which is probably one of the most significant texts anywhere for really proclaiming the gospel, beats the pants off of John 3:16, in my opinion. 2 Corinthians 5:21, God made Him who knew no sin to be sin for us, so that in Him we might become the righteousness of God. Wow. What a text. Because what this nails down is the idea that it's not as if Jesus is dying as the innocent sacrifice. He's actually become guilty because He has become the sin bearer. And see, this is also, I think it's Oswald who argues that Christ becomes the sin bearer at the baptism. And this is when He starts bearing the sins of the world, the act of obedience. He's becoming the sin bearer. He's carrying the sins. And then, so we have the idea of the passion of Christ being His whole life, but then the great passion is what happens focused here on Holy Week, especially starting Maundy Thursday. So now Christ becomes the sin bearer. He's the one carrying the sins. So when He's going to the cross, He's not going as the innocent Son of God. He's going as the sinner of the world, literally carrying all of our sins. And so, what happens on the cross then is the Father sees the Son now become the sin bearer and gives Him the just punishment, which is damnation. Christ endures hell on the cross, not later. The descent into hell, and we'll talk about that later on, is not part of the suffering. The descent into hell is part of the exaltation. He's going to hell to declare the triumph, not going to hell to suffer. The hell that Jesus suffers, and He endures hell, because that's the wages of sin. So Christ endures hell. He endures it on the cross. So He's actually separated from the Father on the cross. Yes?
This is slightly tangential, but I just want to raise this for the class. Often we talk about Jesus suffering in our place. Mm. And when working with youth, be careful with this. I had a youth this summer say, well, why did Jesus only have to suffer on the cross? Why did He not have to suffer eternally, which is our wage?
I was just going there.
So
we're going next.
Well,
so I'm
glad to pick up on that.
Oh, yeah, no. I got you already here. All
right, thank you.
We're ready.
So you're right. This is a great question, and we'll get to that one in a second. So we've got what Christ is enduring on the cross is the full wrath of God, God's judgment. This is important, then, to recognize that the cry of dereliction is not a cry of despair. And be careful with this. Now, in our language, despair just means, oh, he's feeling really bad. But despair is actually kind of a technical term in the church. And in the Middle Ages, especially in Luther's day, despair meant giving up on God. That's despair. Despair is the suicide thing. You give up on God, give up on life, there's no hope, then you despair of life. You take your life. That's despair. And if you pay attention, a lot of the collects we still use in the church will say, save me from untimely death, save me from despair. That doesn't mean save me from depression. It's not what it means. What it means is don't let me lose my faith in the crisis. Don't let me fall away from you when things get tough. Keep me in the faith. That's what it means. Because despair means giving up on God. So you don't ever say that Jesus despaired. He never despaired. Because that's the whole point of the cry of dereliction. He's still calling out to God. But the horror is that when he looks to God, exactly, he looks to God, and instead of getting God's comfort and affirmation, there's no more, this is my beloved son, now there is the rejection. That's the horror of Good Friday. And that accounts for the cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, of course, in the history of the church, there are those, and we'll talk about them later on too, the adoptionists who would say, well, Jesus was just kind of being, you know, filled by God, and what happened was right at the last minute, God bailed out on him. And so when Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? He felt all alone because the God part had left. No, that's not what's going on here. You have God the Son under the wrath of God. Francis Rossa, Brev, calls this the full literal gospel, the damnation of Jesus by the Father. That's the full literal gospel. That's the real deal. Now, you take this, though, and I'll hit the next question is, well, wait a minute now. Hell is eternal. Jesus is on the cross for what? 6 hours? 6 hours versus eternity. Come on! Oh, what? So how do you account for this? How do you answer the high school kid?
Jesus is true God, too, so he can experience the infinite.
All right. There is this aspect of the divinity which does change things. And I know people hate people. You say this, well, he's God. Well, yeah, special pleading. Well, if there's ever a case for special pleading, it would be Jesus, wouldn't it? I mean, he's God. Things are different. So that's that aspect. There's another aspect where you could say, well, you know, Peter says that one day is 1,000 years in God's sight, and so, you know, time doesn't matter. But see, I think the best explanation really is to kind of go this divine aspect and say, now, wait a minute. With God, there is no time. Time is something we have as earthbound creatures. God is outside of time. And see, it's not as if God is, you know, before time or after time. He's just outside of time. For God, it's all now, which is why when Jesus, God says, my name, I am who I am. You know, it's not like was, will be. It's just now. That's it. Continual. That's it. That's it. God just is. So there's a continual present tense for God. So the very fact that this Godhead suffers has this timeless quality to it. Scripture even supports this, where you have Christ pleading before the Father as the sacrifice. And you even have in the book of Revelation where you have the Lamb on the throne, but it's a Lamb as one having been slain. And you have Jesus appearing before Thomas in the resurrected, glorified body. And guess what? The stigmata is still there. The marks are there. And so, and we're going to explore this more with Balcom in marvelous, delicious ways. But that'll be to come. And the marks are there. That's part of it. So in other words, there's something timeless and eternal about this. And in fact, that some have even argued that Christ's sacrifice on the cross is a timeless reality before the Father. This also argues why one of the reasons why we use the crucifix and why St. Paul says we preach Christ and Him crucified. And of course, we put our crucifix up and all the Protestants say, you know, I thought Jesus rose from the dead. you know, my cross is empty. What's wrong with you? Don't you believe Jesus rose? And it's like, idiot. Absolute idiot. You're missing the whole point. Whole point is, it's Christ crucified. That's what we proclaim. And the crucifixion is a timeless, eternal reality. And that's why, remember I said before, see this all together? The crucifixion is never apart from the resurrection. We know He rose. That's why the crucifixion becomes so normative for us. We know He rose. That's why the death is so powerful, because Christ vindicated Him, or God vindicated Him. And so, you see, it all becomes one piece. It's not as if the crucifix negates the resurrection. It's the whole point. It's the whole glory. And that's the really cool thing. And more on that coming in Balcom.
In Revelation, we get a picture of all of us in white robes and Christ in a red robe. Does that play in here?
Yeah, it's what Luther called the divine exchange, the blessed exchange. So God takes my sins, Christ takes my sins, and I get His righteousness. And Dr. Cole likes to call it the sweet swap, good alliteration. So, you know, God takes my sin, I get His righteousness. Pretty cool. That's awesome, in fact. Now, this then sheds a ton of light on Gethsemane, Garden of Gethsemane. We tell the story on Monday, Thursday, and we say, wow, look at the humanity of Jesus. Look how He's in agony. He knows what's going to happen tomorrow. He knows. He's seen the Mel Gibson movie. He knows what's going to happen. It's going to be bad. It's going to be bloody. It's going to be horrible. It's going to be hellacious suffering. He knows, and man, He doesn't want that. That's why He prays so hard for God to take the cup away from Him. I don't buy it. I think what's really going on in the Garden of Gethsemane is the fact that God the Son knows that there is going to be a rift in the Godhead, and that God the Father is going to condemn Him, and that the holy unity in the Godhead, the Trinity itself, is going to be shattered at the cross. That's the agony for Jesus. Suffering, wow, good grief, He's already incarnate. He knows a thing or two about suffering. And so that's not a big deal. Well, it's not small, but it's nothing compared to the real thing. The real thing is, God, who is Jesus, who is sinless, with all of His holiness, is actually going to invite into Himself the sins of all of us. That's That's breathtaking. It's extraordinary. That's the agony. Because he imagined, see, he knows he's the sinless Son of God, and he knows he's going to invite sin into himself, and then for the sake of that sin, he's going to be damned by the Father. He knows this. That's the real heart of the agony in the garden. So I'm persuaded that what you really see in the Garden of Gethsemane is not great evidence of Jesus' humanity, but great evidence of his divinity. I believe that's what's really going on there. All right, so enough there. Anything else on any of this discussion before we press onward? All right, so we back up a little further. We'll back up to Thursday earlier, the last meal, the Last Supper. And here we run into a snag. And it's not without some difficulties. And a lot of you are not even aware of this because we don't pay much attention. But if you actually read the Gospels, it becomes very apparent very quickly. And the snag is this. We have the last meal or the Last Supper. And then the question is, what's the context for the Last Supper? All right, the Passover, which is clearly the answer that you get in the Synoptics. So in the Synoptics, we are told Jesus wants to prepare the Passover. He sends Peter and John into town. They meet the guy with the pot on his head, and off they go. You know, they find the upper room. They prepare the Passover. Then they have the Passover meal. All good. Well, we have a problem. Exactly. John's Gospel says that, no, the Passover was going to be celebrated Friday night, which is why the Sanhedrin would not go into Pilate's presence when they were pressing for the crucifixion on Friday morning, because they didn't want to be desecrated, because if you go into a Gentile home and become unclean, you're unclean for a good 24-hour period. Ah, guess what? You miss the festivities. They didn't want that to happen, so they wouldn't go in. And so they hold themselves back because they don't want to go in, because that night is when the Passover is going to be celebrated. Now, for John's purposes, this creates a rather fantastic correspondence. Because now in John's Gospel, what you get is this. In John's Gospel, you get all the lambs for all the Passover meals all being brought to the temple on Friday afternoon and being slaughtered in the temple. The Passover lambs for the sake of the people's sins. Meanwhile, what's happening just outside of town? The Passover lamb is being sacrificed. It's like, oh man, wow, is that cool. And in case you miss the connections, and John doesn't want you to miss anything, John is the only one of the gospel writers who gives us in the seven last words from the cross, John is the one who gives us, I'm thirsty. Synoptics don't have it. Only John has it. I'm thirsty. And then what happens next? The Roman soldier quick grabs a sponge, soaks it in his vinegar water, puts it on a stick, and holds it up to Jesus' mouth. Well, what kind of stick did you put it on? Yeah, stalk of the hyssop branch. Which immediately, you know your Septuagint, and you know the same exact word is the word for the material they used for their paintbrush on the Passover in Egypt when they painted their doorposts with the blood of the lamb. They used the hyssop. Because hyssop is kind of like parsley, which is a rather weird thing to use to bring the sponge up to Jesus' mouth, but that's what John tells us they did, and the connections are not to be missed. So John is just screaming it at you. Remember, he's the one who has John the Baptist saying, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. This is John's gospel. He doesn't want you to miss it. He's the Lamb of God. So this is powerful, really cool stuff. Saw a hand.
I was just making the connection to also in the Psalms, cleanse me with hyssop and I will be clean.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, you get this too. Now, the problem we got, though, is John's gospel has a different scenario. He has it, the Passover is on Friday. So now we have a snag. Who's right? Well, things, now we start coming up with what are we going to do with this? We know that the Passover always happened on the 14th of Nisan. We know that. So the question comes, well, when did it fall? And we start getting into all kinds of discussion about this. So this is also one of the reasons why it makes it a little difficult to pin down the exact day that Jesus died. Because was it really a Friday night Passover or was it a Thursday night Passover? It changes everything. Because we can do, you know, astronomical records and figure things out. But when was it exactly? So some questions. Now, on the face of it, it looks like, well, somebody screwed up. Either the Synoptics got it wrong or John got it wrong. Someone's wrong. So then we say, well, wait a minute, maybe not so fast. Meyer explores this, so does Stein. How do we get around this? Well, there are ways, and one of the ways is to say, well, and these are all now possibilities. hypotheses. One is you got Jesus and the 11 or the 12. They're all basically Galileans. And so probably you had a Galilean tradition and then a Judean tradition. They're different places. And so maybe they were actually counting the calendar differently. And they weren't really agreed on when the 14th of Nisan actually fell. Maybe they're off by a day. Maybe you have a Galilean tradition going on. That's one possibility. So you have maybe a calendar issue. Another possibility is maybe Jesus knew what was going to be happening on Passover, and so he just kind of moved the Passover up, like some of you do when you have Thanksgiving on Saturday or Friday, because you can't all get together on Thursday, so you actually have your Thanksgiving on a different day. People do this with Christmas all the time, and we even call it having Christmas, right? So when are we going to have Christmas this year? We're going to have Christmas on the 23rd. Or we're going to have Christmas with your family on the 24th. We'll have it with my family on the 28th. That's when we're going to have Christmas, right? We talk that way. So maybe that's what's going on. So maybe Jesus had Passover a little early. Maybe, kind of similar, maybe Passover is a little bit like our Christmas. When do you actually have Christmas? December 25th, December 24th. Which tradition is your family? In my family, everything happens on the 24th. 25th, yeah, everything's kind of low-key. We don't do much because all the big stuff happened on the 24th. Presents are open, the whole business, all on the 24th. And my wife's tradition. It's mine now. And so so this is how it happens. So, you know, when is it going on? So maybe that's what we have here. Maybe we have Passover kind of just spills out. And you can have some people who are Passover Eve, you know, almost. Maybe that's what's going on here. There's one other possibility. There's also been suggested that Jerusalem is so crowded. The rules are very clear. The Passover had to be celebrated in the city of Jerusalem. Well, there's only so much room for so many pilgrims, and so to accommodate them all, the Sanhedrin just kind of said Passover is a two-night thing. That way we can have the A group and then the B group. And so if you're alphabet, you know, A through M, you do it on Thursday night, and if you're Z, N through Z, you know, whatever. You know, so in other words, we come up with the possibility to kind of just spread it out to accommodate everybody. That's possible. We already know for a fact that they actually did extend the civil city limits out to include the whole hillside of the, Mount of Olives was included as part of the city of Jerusalem to accommodate all the pilgrims who couldn't fit in the city limits. So they just said that's the city as well, so they could be within the restrictions of the law by making Jerusalem a little bigger for the event. So any of these are possible. Now, like we encounter with Stein many times, do we know which answer is the right answer? No. But one of these could be, and if we have a possible correct answer, that's enough. So is there a way to reconcile John and the Synoptics? Yeah. All right. More importantly for our purposes is whatever's going on, Passover is clearly in the minds of Jesus and the disciples at this meal. It's Passover season, and Passover is heavy on their brain, which is fantastic on so many levels, because the Passover then becomes the setting within which Christ is going to give the sacrament and then give his life and then proceed into the entire whole crucifixion-resurrection nexus. The whole thing is premised on Passover. In fact, in every language except for English, this is apparent in the names for Easter. Because in most languages, what do we call Easter? Some form of Pascha, Pesach, whatever. And it comes straight out of the Hebrew. The word for Hebrew for Passover is Pesach, all right? And that comes right into the most languages. So only in English do we get stuck with this lousy name for Easter. Because where's the derivation for Easter? Yeah, it comes from a pagan goddess of the east, of the sunrise and of the new spring, Oster. And so that's where we get this. It's a pagan goddess, actually. So, and springtime, new life goddess, and so we call Easter after her. Kind of stupid. You know, we should really probably try to rename Easter and just call it Pascha or whatever. Now, this also shows up, though, what do we call Christ all the time? We call him the Paschal Lamb, because the Paschal then has the idea of Passover. That's all it means, the Passover Lamb. So this is the setting. Think about this. It's Passover evening. They're doing the Seder traditions, whatever they were at the time. And don't assume that everything going on today in a Jewish Seder meal is what was going on in Jesus' day. We don't know that for a fact. But all the traditions are happening. And what we do know is they're retelling the Exodus story. It's heavy on their brain. They're thinking about this stuff. And then suddenly, in the midst of the meal, Jesus introduces, "You're all going to betray me." And then Judas does his thing and dismisses. And then Jesus, either before or after Judas leaves, we don't know, he institutes the Lord's Supper. "This is my body, and then this is my blood." And the disciples are already thinking blood of the Lamb, sacrifice, Red Sea, through the water, new life, promised land. And then Jesus takes all of these images, all these realities, and just blows them forward with all this new meaning. You want to talk about an exodus? We'll talk about the exodus into new life. You want to talk about a promised land? We'll talk about the promised land of the eschatological kingdom. You want to talk about a lamb who is sacrificed? We'll talk about the Lamb of God who dies bearing the sins of the world. You want to talk about a scapegoat who takes sins? I'm the ultimate one who takes sins. It's just phenomenal, all these levels, which is why in the traditional pericopes, the Old Testament reading for Easter is Exodus, a story of through the Red Sea. I still remember using this in the parish, and some of my parishioners saying, what the heck are we reading this story for on Easter? And the answer is, because that's the Easter story in embryo. This is the whole typological connection thing. It's so cool. So cool. So what you begin to get is when you start to really dig into this stuff is Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, Easter are so full of meaning, you cannot overplay them, the significance. And what you begin to realize is these are the best worship services of the entire year. They really are. And when I was a parish, I loved Holy Week. It's as good as it gets. And you'll talk to pastors sometimes, oh, it's Holy Week, I'm so busy. Ah, you're missing the whole point. This is as good as it gets. I mean, you get to walk through these things. And then you have this whole idea of this God rift happening on Friday. How can you even speak of this? It's just so huge. Good Friday is just, wow. And then the resurrection and the restoration and the putting everything back and the being led into the Holy Land and the eschatological fulfillment. It's like, wow. How can you ever possibly plumb the depths of this? It's just too good. So, my little practical word of advice. Now I'm sliding into P class here. Forgive me. Enjoy Holy Week like crazy, guys, okay? And make sure your people see how hugely significant this is and make these services profound and work on them and make them significant so that Thursday and Friday and Sunday become not missed services so people don't see them as optionals. Oh, it's a busy week. They just be, if you're a Christian, you can't miss. One of the things I did, just a little really concrete advice, I would preach Thursday night, Friday, and two sermons on Sunday. Two different sermons, Easter, because I would have a sunrise service and we'd have a festival service, and they were two different services, but everybody in the congregation was encouraged to come to both because they were completely different services, and it was really a lot of fun. So I had to write four sermons. So I would always go on a little retreat. So I would leave Monday after, or Sunday sometimes even after church, but Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday I'd be gone, come home usually by Wednesday at noon, and when I was away, I'd go to this camp not just south of where we were. They had food, it was great, and I could be in solitude, and I'd just crank out all four sermons. Bang, got them all done. So when I came home on Wednesday, all four sermons were in the bag, and I could sit back and actually enjoy the week. It was a lot of fun. Dye eggs, you know, the whole business with all the kids and everything. So just give it a shot. You know, it worked out really well for me. And so enjoy Holy Week, and do your best to bring the depth of this, because this is such cool stuff.
Are you familiar with the, early church services that would happen when Christianity dominated the Middle East?
I'm not as much. I mean, this is Burson's bailiwick, and I'm not as in depth in that kind of stuff.
It was almost like nobody slept.
Right. This is one long thing from Thursday on. It's just like a continual kind of a service, right? And you didn't stop it. That's right. It just dominated the lives of the people, which is kind of a cool thing. All right. Good. So we got that covered, we got Thursday covered, we got everything's pretty much done here. Then a couple of the dates here on Holy Week, we've got the Monday clearing of the temple. Tuesday would be the day of confrontation, when Jesus went toe-to-toe with all the Sanhedrin officials. And then either Tuesday evening or Wednesday, depending on how you read the text, you've got the whole Olivet Discourse, or the little apocalypse, where Jesus is kind of laying everything out, what's going to happen. And the setting for that is so cool, too, because you've got Jesus sitting on the Mount of Olives, right across from the Temple Mount, Kidron Valley in between, looking straight across to the temple in all of its splendor and telling the disciples about when it's all going to come to an end. Pretty cool. And then, of course, Thursday we have the Last Supper, and Peter and John spend the day getting everything ready, and then everything goes from there. So that pretty much lays out all of Holy Week. All right, final questions or comments about anything else here? Yep.
I see in chapter 15 he mentions when God made the animal skins for Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
I never heard that parallelism before.
Oh, this shedding of blood already, right? Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, it's actually, that's got some substance behind it. That's a tradition in the church. So that's pretty good. Yep, it is good stuff. All right, anything else in Stein, or I mean in Metaxas, or any kind of loose ends you wanted to talk about, or things you really wanted to get straightened out because you think it's really weird? Because we do have about 2 minutes left. Anything else? Your chance. Yep.
It's Martin Luther said the divine nature of Christ is created in the eternity of God.
Yeah.
On the other hand, human nature of Christ is created in
time.
In time.
Correct.
But the cross is a historical event.
Correct.
Yeah, but that means the present time is affect to the eternal time.
Exactly. A present time reality has impact for eternity.
When we consider the present time today and eternity of God, the time of God, mm-hmm. is a correlation, correlate each other, the present time affect to eternal time, or eternal time is a...
It's a great question. When we start talking about God's timelessness, I always just complete ignorance. I can't conceive. No, seriously. And I don't think I'm just kind of wimping out on this. I'm a human. I'm a creature. I am so time-bound, I cannot imagine timelessness. I just can't. And so I just have to kind of say, I'm a creature. I can't get it. I'll yield to God's godness and admit that I don't get it and leave it at that. So that's where I go. Yep.
When you were talking about the meal that Jesus had, the Last Supper, and you were talking about the kind of synapses in his head, what was going on with the Passover and what he was doing, can you just kind of review that? You went over it really fast. What was he thinking?
Well, what Jesus was thinking, I have no clue. I'm not Jesus, and I don't ever like to speculate. But what I do know is the whole kind of context of this, the Passover. You've got 400 years of bondage, and now finally it's coming to an end. You've got all these plagues have been being dumped on Egypt, this kind of wrath of God being poured out. And then now, finally, we've got this last big, great, you know, event of the angel of death going through the land. But Israel spared because of the blood over their doorposts. And then Israel plundering Egypt and going through the Red Sea into the Promised Land, the Holy Land, the Land of Promise, led through the Red Sea. And see, all of this stuff is just kind of kicking around. It's in this. It's in the air. It's in the food. It's in the taste. It's in the wine. It's just thick in the disciples' minds. And Jesus takes that whole event with all this kind of pregnant reality around it and says, "Ah, this is my body. This is my blood. And so now you want to talk about deliverance, I'm the deliverer. You want to talk about Holy Land, the Holy Land, that's the eschatological fulfillment. That's the Holy Land. You want to talk about suffering, this is what I will be enduring." I mean, see, the whole thing, almost on every level, there's all these connections where the typology is there in reality, in history, and then just blown to a whole other dimension. That's what you get going on. This is going to get reviewed again in Balcom, and so we'll spend a little more time on it. All right? Okay, good. So we are set for Balcom next. A little different style from Metaxas. So enjoy. We'll see you back on Tuesday. Have a good weekend.